So the topic of today's talk is spike timing. And I have a PowerPoint presentation prepared that has some experimental data on it, but I thought it would be worthwhile to give a little prelude to the talk, doing a little bit of a Bill Bialik here on the blackboard. To really just look at the issue from a broader perspective. So one of the, probably the most important fact about brains is that neurons have on-on spikes. So there are many universal principles, and this, I think, is one of the most important. Now, if you look in the cortex, and that's where we're going to be focusing, like all neurons, they also spike. But if you record, say, from using an extracellular microelectrode stuck in the cortex, if you record a spike train in response to a sensory stimulus, typically what people have reported since the time of Hubel and Wiesel, when this experiment was first done back in 1959 or so, what people have reported is that the spike train is, first of all, very irregular, Poisson-like in character. And furthermore, if you repeat, say, a stimulus, say you have a flash visual stimulus that goes on here and continues and ends here, what Hubel and Wiesel reported and what everyone believes is that that spike train will vary from trial to trial. That is to say, the times of individual spikes will vary from trial to trial, such that the only thing that you can count on that is, say, statistically significant is either the total number of spikes during that trial, say it's 100 milliseconds long, you get on average 8 spikes, that means it's firing at 80 hertz, that's a typical number for a cortical cell. But it will vary, it may be 8 spikes one trial, maybe 10 the next, maybe 5 the other, and the spike times will vary. Well, one of the things you have to ask yourself is, how were the experiments actually done? And if you go back and read the original Hubel and Wiesel paper, in fact, it's one of the few in the literature where they actually show you their raw data, right? Where they, raw spike trains. More commonly now, they show you what's called the spike time histogram, or the PST, post-stimulus time histogram. So what they do is they do this 10 times, and then they give you the histogram of spike counts, so that you can see that there is a burst of firing at the beginning of the stimulus, and then it returns back to its baseline level, someplace down here, a few spikes per second. But the conditions under which those experiments were done were very primitive by today's standards. That is to say, they were done with handheld projectors. This was both a strength and a weakness. It was a strength because it means they could adjust their stimulus very rapidly. They could put different things in the projector. For example, what Hubel and Wiesel found were that a really effective set of stimuli were little bars like this, that they could literally sweep across the field, vary their orientation, size, width, parameters that they could then use to adjust to try to get the maximum firing rate from that cortical neuron, and then try to plot out how the different properties of the neurons are displayed across the cortex in some organized pattern. But if you think about it for a minute, right? If these individual traces, if these individual trials were a consequence of sweeping across with your hand, how reliable or how well can you control that? The velocity of the sweep, the exact angle, right? Those are all things that the cell may be exquisitely sensitive to. And so you really have to be very careful about any statement about cells not being reliable or spike times not being important. But nonetheless, this has persisted as a tradition, as it often is the case when someone has developed an experiment that has a reproducible result. People tend to use the same paradigm over and over again. And since that first paper that was published in 1962 in Journal of Physiology, there have been literally thousands of papers recording from thousands and thousands of cells throughout the brain using basically the same paradigm. Flash a stimulus, or if it's an auditory, the tone, or if it's somatosensory, repeat over and over again and look for cells that respond to that stimulus. Now, the other, of course, the other part of the, I think the appeal is that if you actually look at these neurons biophysically, what you discover is that they're studded with synapses all over, thousands and thousands of synapses. Each one of the elementary inputs, excitatory or inhibitory, is a very small fraction, maybe 10% or less, of the stimulus that you need in order to reach threshold. So the actual membrane potential of the neuron is very irregular. So with more modern techniques, it's possible to record intracellularly, so you can patch the electrode in and record intracellular membrane potentials. And there, what you discover is that it fluctuates very rapidly, plus or minus about 5 to 10 millivolts or so. And you get the occasional spike, very rapid millisecond event, superimposed on the fluctuating background. And it's irregular, and it has the same characteristics you see recording extracellularly. But the key there to keep in mind is that even in the absence of a sensory stimulus, you have this rapidly fluctuating background because there's spontaneous activity. These cells are not off unless there's a stimulus, right? These cells are always firing in response to nothing. This is the background activity. And the timing is irregular such that you don't see any correlated activity here, at least not apparent. There's correlated inputs. And that when you do get a spike, it must mean that a number within, a 10 or 20 millisecond window, enough EPSPs, excitatory events, these little synaptic potentials, have occurred to reach threshold. Now, based on this technology, most of the physiologists who study cortical neurons have concluded that most of the information in the spike train is contained in the total number of spikes, or the average firing rate. That's the rate theory. And I don't think there's any doubt that there is a lot of information in the rate. The only question that has been raised recently is whether there's additional information or whether there is some other function that could be assigned to the actual timing of individual spikes. So what can we say about spike timing? Now, a lot of people have contributed to this. Bill Bialik, for example, and Rob DeReuter have looked at flies and found that there's a lot of information in the actual timing of the spike that encode information about the motion of the background. So it's clear that in some systems, at least, in the fly, there is. The answer is yes, but that's not the cortex. In fact, there's abundant information in the periphery in our brains that we're using spike timing, for example, in the auditory system. We have two ears, and we use the relative timing of spikes coming from the cochlea converging onto single neurons in a part of the auditory system, subcortical auditory system, in which that is sensitive to the relative timing on the order of a tenth of a millisecond, 100 microsecond timing. And that gives you information about the localization of where the object is located to about plus or minus a few degrees, if I say 5 degrees. So in our auditory system, the tau for discrimination is on the order of 100 microseconds. But biology can do even better. There are specialized systems, for example, bat echolocation, where actively the animal is producing a sound and it's looking at the time delays of the echo, of the return of the echo, where it's believed that you can push this tau down to a tenth of a microsecond. And electrosensory systems, for example, in specialized fish that actually generate an electric field in the water and use the variations in the field around the body in order to detect objects and conspecifics, those fish, if you look at their sensory system that is responsible, the electroreceptors and the early processing stages, again, you find that they're capable of discriminating timing on the order of a microsecond or less, all suggesting that if nature wants to get a really fine timing accomplished and use that information in an important way, it's quite capable of doing it, right? There's no doubt about that. The only question is whether or not this is done in the visual system. And specifically the cortex. It may be, for example, people may grant that in the retina you may have good timing, but maybe not in the cortex. Now there's one really nifty result that most people don't know about, which I think is just from knowing this result, you can sort of guess that the visual cortex really has to be able to deal with single spikes. And it has to do with a phenomenon called hyperacuity. So the optics in our eye is really not that good, right? That is to say, if you look at the point spread function for a single, say, a point of light on the retina, we have experts here on the retina. Where's Peter Sterling? So Peter here is here, and he's one of the world's leading experts on retinal neuroanatomy. But even before you get to the neurons, you have to deal with the optics. And so a little point is spread out on the retina in a nice Gaussian shape. And the half widths here, I think, are on the order of a minute or two of arc. So this is about 60 seconds of arc or so. However, despite the fact that you cannot resolve, say, two points that are closer together than about one or two arc minutes, you can resolve the offset between two lines, say two vertical lines. So you have one vertical line here and another vertical line here. And the question is, what is the minimum delta, vernier offset, that your visual system is capable of reliably detecting? And this is something that Gerald Westheimer has called vernier hyperacuity. And what's amazing is that it's down in the 1 to 2 arc second range. And what makes that number impressive, not just that it's much smaller than the blur, but what makes it really impressive is that the size of a photoreceptor is around a half arc minute, or about 30 arc seconds. That is, say, the cone, the size of the cone, the granularity of the actual detector is roughly an order of magnitude, between 1 and 2 orders of magnitude larger than what you're capable of detecting by pooling across a large number of photoreceptors. And it's not just with lines, you can do this with spots, you can do it with a wide range of visual patterns. Not only can you do it with stationary flash patterns, you can also do it with patterns that are moving across the retina at several degrees per second. So that means that you don't even have to use the same pool. You could integrate over a moving pool. Almost certainly that's going to be integrating in the cortex, right? I can't imagine this happening in the retina. Or maybe it's possible, but it really requires special purpose machinery to actually be able to do that.
How does it depend on the length?
It doesn't. You can do it with spots like this. I think there may be some parametric, there may be something that modulates this threshold depending on the number, the size, and so forth. But these are highly practiced humans really pushing the threshold. Your thresholds are probably not quite this good. They're probably in the range of 5 to 10 arc seconds. But this is something actually you can get better with practice. So if you did this every day for a week or two, you can push it down further and further, and this is about the limit you can get it to. So Misha, for example, has thought a lot about this from the perspective of perceptual learning, and what kind of synaptic mechanisms would you need in order to be able to achieve this. So it's really fascinating to look at the limits where you're pushing the system to its extreme operating ability. I want to mention one other thing, though, in the context of hyperacuity, and that has to do with a very simple but, I think, illustrative model that Thomas Wachtler worked on for his PhD thesis with Christian Verhaan in Tübingen, and subsequently he came to the Salk Institute and worked as a postdoc with Tom Albright, who studies monkey visual cortex, and my lab, and we extended this. But he was focusing primarily on this issue of hyperacuity, and he developed a model of retinal ganglion cells. So retinal ganglion cells in the primate come in roughly two categories. There are many subcategories, but there's one class called the magno and one class called the parvo. And they differ in many respects. Parvo, as you can imagine, they have smaller cell bodies. They also have smaller receptive fields. It's the region in the visual field which, when you stimulate the cell, will produce activity. And they have this nice center surround organization, excitatory center, inhibitory surround. Well, the magnos are much bigger, and also they're capable of detecting much lower contrast sensitivity. That is to say, you don't need a big difference in the light illumination in the middle compared to the outside. And also, it's believed by virtue of the connections that they make in the cortex that the magno are much more selective for moving objects. That is to say, they carry information about motion, right? So here's what Thomas did. He developed a very simple model where he took the responses of recorded responses of magno and parvo cells in response to stimuli like these, right? He laid down, these are now excitatory centers of these receptive fields. He laid down the stimulus on his array. He calculated roughly the number of spikes from each one of the ganglion cells, and then asked the question of what was the difference in the pattern of spike firing under the two conditions where these two are aligned or off by an arc second, right? Very simple question, and it's possible to answer it with known measurements. And what was shocking was, well, two things. One is a little surprising, and the second thing is shocking. The surprising thing is that the magno is, although it's bigger and, you know, can be thought of as being sloppier in terms of the number of cells and their resolution, actually carries more information about hyperacuity than the parvo system. Of course, everybody thought the parvo cells are small, they must be the ones that have the highest acuity. That's not true. It's really misleading to think that the size of the receptive field has anything to do with acuity, because you have to look at the population. If you want to know what the information content is, it's not carried by any single cell, it's carried by a large number of cells working together as a population. The second thing, which I thought was shocking, is that the number of spikes, just on average, because there's some stochastic variability, but the number of spikes between these two conditions is on the order of one. That is to say, only a few spikes are different between these two conditions. And that means your visual system is working at a level where it can make fine discriminations based on just a few spikes.
This is not for one cell.
No, this is over the whole population. Right. Just think about it. I mean, you're moving one arc second over the photoreceptors. It's not going to produce a big change in the firing patterns.
How big is the total population? Yeah, is it 10, 100,000?
Here it's a few hundred to 1,000. And again, it depends on how big your stimulus is and the details. But yeah, we're talking about the groups of cells that are on the order of 100 or so, a few hundred. So this is just to set the stage and just to give you a little bit of background on why you might actually want to pay attention to a spike, because it may make a big difference if you're pushing the system to its limit. And certainly we know that in other parts of the brain, that information can be used in a very powerful way.
So, remember, percentage-wise, you know, you say it's few spikes, but few compared to what percentage of the difference?
A few out of 1,000 or two. It's not a lot of spikes. If you're interested in following it up, this was published in Journal of Computational Neuroscience probably about 5 years ago.
In that case, the stimulus was the flash bars?
Yeah, flash bars, so brief flashes. Good. Okay, so that sort of gives you a little bit of background, which I'm going to now present some experimental data. So before we can make any statement about what information is contained in a single cortical spike, or what cortical spikes, what they represent, we really need to get to the biophysical level very quickly to understand what a single cell is capable of. Now, as I said earlier, there's this intuitive feeling that these pyramidal cells are sloppy integrators. Why? Because they have thousands of synapses on them. The inputs are coming in randomly. The time constant over which you're averaging, just the membrane time constant, is on the order of 25 milliseconds. So it makes sense that, well, it's some kind of a low-pass filter. And, you're just interested in how many spikes come in roughly over that window. So, that gives you a kind of a nice, comfortable, intuitive model. Well, if you actually look at the experiments and the facts, in fact, they contradict that intuitive model. So here's an experiment that was done by Zach Manin when he was a graduate student in my lab. It was published in Science in 1995, and it really put the spotlight on precision. Zach is now at the Cold Spring Harbor Lab, where he has developed a very vigorous research program studying olfactory system. This is from a cortical slice from the visual cortex of a rat. So this is in vitro. You take the brain, you put it in a dicer, you cut it into little slices, thin slices, a few hundred microns thick. That contains a few hundred cells. And you can visualize those under the microscope. You can impale them. You can inject current into them. And you can study their biophysical properties. And this is a technique that's been very well established. And the traditional experiment that's done is to inject a stimulus like this, a square pulse, similar to the kind of stimulus that you might imagine a flash of light would produce. And when you do that, this is a stimulus that lasts for 1 second. You produce a sequence of spikes, and this is a single trial. Each tick mark represents a single spike. Bang, 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 and it continues on at a roughly constant rate after initial transient, and the transient is there because there are intrinsic currents within the neuron, primarily potassium currents that adapt, that change their conductance with time when you depolarize. And so after that initial period, you settle down to a more or less constant rate. Now, as I said earlier, you typically repeat these trials over and over again. Here's 50 trials. And then you typically average across trials in small bins. And this is binning on the order of a millisecond. So you can see that at the very beginning, that first spike occurs at a very fixed time interval after the stimulus comes on. And that produces a very thin spike, which thin event in the histogram. Thin meaning that it has a high precision, small jitter, and is high in the sense that almost all trials spike. If you integrated under that curve, you'd find that the area was on the order of 49 or 50. But after that initial transient, after the first 100 milliseconds, you can see that these spikes start drifting, and this PST settles down to an average, which is on the order of 10 spikes per second. But there's very little information in the timing. And of course, this is what everyone believes. Everyone believes these are sloppy integrators who are averaging over time, and what really carries the information is just the average number of spikes. Well, the only time you ever get a membrane potential in a neuron that is as flat as that is when the neuron is dead. And this happens in slices quite regularly. But if you record in vivo, intracellularly, as I showed earlier, you find a high degree of fluctuation. So Zach's insight was to take a synthesized fluctuating stimulus and inject it repeatedly into the neuron. This is could be called frozen noise. That very same pattern is injected over and over again. And see how it responds. And so here now are 50 trials, 50 responses to the very same fluctuating stimulus. over and over and over again, and now you can see the pattern looks quite different. There are these vertical stripes corresponding to events that have very fine precision on the order of a millisecond or less. The precision depends on the frequency content and the amplitude of the fluctuations, and for the values you typically find in cortical cells, it's on the order of a half a millisecond. And these peaks are such that it's, some of them at least are very reliable as the very first trial. What that suggests is that however the information is being integrated, the actual precision of the spike initiation has a sub-millisecond precision. So nature has enough channels. What this really means, okay, when this was first published, it wasn't quite clear how to take it, but I think that the way that I now look back on it is that is as a measurement of the intrinsic noise in the spike-generating mechanism, right? Because if there was a lot of noise, there would be a lot more jitter. And so it means that the way you reduce noise, of course, is to increase the number of channels, ion channels, in this case, sodium ion channels that are responsible for the action potential and for triggering it. And this is telling us that, in a sense, the pyramidal cells are over-engineered. They don't need to be that precise. Why should they be half a millisecond precision if their job is just to integrate over 25 milliseconds? So it's telling us that, gee, you know, these really are precision components. They're as precise as some of the cells in the cochlear nucleus. We really ought to be thinking about what that could be used for. Now, the other criticism, of course, is that, well, this is a slice. You know, it's an artificial experiment in vitro. You've taken it out of the animal. The animal is in this milieu where there are temperature fluctuations, and there are, because we have a constant temperature, well, neuromodulators, and, you know, even if it's precise in the dish, put it in the animal and it's going to disappear. So we were fortunate that at the time that we were doing this, an experiment was going on at Stanford. Bill Newsom was doing an experiment which had a very profound impact on our understanding of how single neurons can code information. This is from an area of the visual cortex that codes, has many cells in it, that are selective for direction of motion. It's called MT, or the motion processing area. And what they were doing was to test the level at which a single, say, a monkey can discriminate from a field of randomly moving dots that are being presented sequentially, but at rapid pace, can detect a correlated motion, say, to the right. So the monkey is sitting there, awake and behaving, and it can make two choices, right or left, depending on, see, the cell has a receptive field here, and therefore you're stimulating the receptive field. You can record the spike patterns from the cell for correlations moving to the right or to the left, and the monkey has to make the decision. Now, the thresholds here are on the order of 5%. So monkey can make very fine discriminations. Just needs a few dots, really, to make that decision. Buried in a background of noise. But the experiment was designed in such a way that every time that the stimulus was generated, a random seed was picked so that the actual positions of the dots were randomized. You know, you don't want the monkey to memorize the particular stimulus. You want to be able to vary that and just respond to the statistical properties of the stimulus. And if you do that properly, and if you do, in this case, 200 trials, you get a histogram that looks like this. It looks a lot like the histogram in the experiment that we did in the slice, right, when you give it a constant stimulus. Well, more evidence that the nervous system is using rate coding. Now, as Bill was doing these experiments, there was a spy in his lab from Caltech. This is Wyeth Baer. And Wyeth was a student of Christof Koch, and they had some wild idea that the bursts of, that these are single spikes, but occasionally the cell actually fires in a burst, rapid sequence of spikes, say three or four in the space of 10 milliseconds. And so they had this theory that those bursts carried an important piece of information about the consciousness of the animal, whatever that means. And they didn't find it. They found that the bursts really didn't carry that much more information than individual spikes. But in the process of doing that, what Wyeth discovered in analyzing their data was occasionally he'd get histograms that look like this, a lot closer to the one that Zach found when he injected fluctuating frozen noise into the cell. So they tracked it down. It turned out to be a bug in the software that was not changing the random seed. So for these 200 trials, exactly the same pattern of dots was coming on and off and over again, right? It's a frozen visual stimulus. And what this is telling us is that the cell was responding to structures. Somehow the information between the retina and MT, which is about 10 synapses deep, was preserving timing information about specific dots that were patterns of dots. And unfortunately, they didn't actually keep any of the random seeds, so they don't know what the stimulus was. But it was clear that in vivo, in a wake-behaving monkey, far, far from the periphery, there was information, and it was preserved with a jitter of about 5 milliseconds. Now, that may not be too surprising to you, because I just told you that, well, a single cell in the cortex is 1 millisecond, but it should be surprising if I tell you one other fact about the cortex, and that is that the synapses are very unreliable. The typical synapse in the cortex only responds, that is to say, transmits information 1/10 of the time. That is to say, for every 10 inputs, you only get one vesicle out. It's probabilistic at the level of individual synapses. Now, there are some synapses that are more reliable, and there's a spectrum. The peak is around a few tenths, and then it tapers down, and there's only a few up in the range above a half. So not all synapses are equal, but most, by far the great majority, are probabilistic. And so what this is saying is that despite that probabilistic character, that there's a deterministic component that emerges by virtue of all the convergence and all the flow of information through the different stages of visual processing. So that gave us some confidence that there's a signal here that we can track down and that it might be used under some circumstances. So another study was done a few years ago, recording now from cats and from the first stage of processing after the retina in the lateral geniculate nucleus. This is one of these Latin terms that is used to confuse people who aren't neuroanatomists. The LGN is part of the thalamus, and all the information going into the cortex first synapses on these neurons in the thalamus. So it's kind of a relay station. So they were recording from these neurons, and they wanted to test the precision. How precise was the timing of those neurons getting converging input now from the retina? In the retina itself, there's a synapse from the photoreceptor to the bipolar, and the bipolar to the ganglion cell, and then the ganglion cell to the LGN. So there's a chain of four synapses there just to begin with. And so here's the stimulus. It consisted of whole field flicker. And the intensity is varying as a function of time. It's rapidly changing from values. But it's whole field. There's no spatial structure. So here, looking at the very top here, here's 128 trials in which they use the same convention, where a dot is a spike. So this is a raster plot. And what this illustrates is that for this class of cells, these were off-center X cells, that there were events that were very precise. In fact, the leading edge had a precision of about 0.5 milliseconds. So the retinal system is capable of encoding at that level of precision. But I think what really got my attention, and I added this because they don't actually say this, you have to really look for it. It turns out that this is 7 different cells from 7 different animals. And they have a wide range of average firing rates from 3.6 up to 41 spikes per second. But I think what you'll see immediately is that the timing of an event is actually quite reliable. That is to say, is reproducible across a wide range of cells in different animals. What this means is that almost every cell probably in the LGN that is responding is capable of firing at roughly the same time to this flickering stimulus. Now, it's not the case that, obviously, there are fewer spikes here than here, so what's the story? Well, we can trace some of these. For example, here's something that reliably fires at high rates, but not for cells that are firing at a low rate. So it's clear that as you increase the firing rate of the cell through neuromodulators or whatever, the state of arousal of the animal, what you're doing is preserving the events that will have occurred at lower rates, but you're adding new spikes. You're doing that in a precise and reliable way.
This is full field flickering for
stimulus. Right, full field flickering. So this puts us in a position because this is the input to the cortex, right? We're not talking here about some peripheral processing center, you know, some obscure mechanism that might be present in the auditory system. This is the visual system. This is the LGN. This is going right to the cortex. The cortex is getting these precisely timed spikes. And so this inspired us to embark on a whole series of studies. And I'm going to present just a few of the results, just to give you a flavor for them, to ask the following question. What are, first of all, the biophysical properties of the cells that endow them with this ability to respond very reliably? And reliable means that you will fire every time. See, here's an event that looks like it's precise. The jitter is small, but it's not reliable. Only half the time the cell fires. So I would say 50% reliability with a precision of, you know, maybe 1 or 2 milliseconds. So just to start out, to make sure that we can understand the Pam Reinagle experiment. By the way, is she here?
Yes, she
left. Okay.
Was here, will be here.
Okay, well, I picked a precisely optimal time for missing her. So what we did was to repeat her experiment in the slice. Namely, we took a single cell, we gave it frozen noise, and we varied the amplitude of the frozen noise, thereby driving the cell at low amplitudes at 4 spikes per second, up to 30 spikes per second, and the character of this spike timing histogram. Each one of these is about 50 trials, and then we increase the rate, another 50 trials. So you can see it's very precise, and as you increase the firing rate, you get more and more events at different times, but it's preserved. In other words, the time at which this event occurs is roughly the same across an order of magnitude firing rate.
Just add the DC or you multiply?
We did it both ways. I think in this particular case we changed the pedestal, but you can also do it by increasing the amplitude of the RMS. One of the problems with using fluctuating noise stimuli is that it has lots of different frequencies. So we took one step backwards and started using simpler stimuli. And what could be simpler than just injecting a sine wave? And if you do that and repeat it 100 times, you get a raster that looks like this. And if you look at it very cursorily, I think you'll agree that it's clearly very precise, the timing is precise, but the reliability, which starts out at 100%, is at this point goes down to about 50%. And the reason it goes down is that you have these adapting currents. So it's able to follow the sine wave for the first 10 or so trials, 1 second, 2 second. I think this is about, looks like it's about 6 hertz, 8 hertz. But then it can't follow it. It turns out that the frequency with which a cell can follow a sine wave depends on the cell. For pyramidal cells, the optimal frequency is on the order of 6 to 8 hertz. But for inhibitory interneurons, which are the ones that are local in the cortex, you can go up to 40 hertz, the peak reliability, in terms of being able to follow every single peak is in the 30 to 60 hertz range. Now, okay, so that tells maybe the cells really are unreliable in some respects if you don't have exactly the right stimulus. Oops. But it turns out that you're deceived by your eyes. It turns out that histogram display actually obscures some important information. Now, if you look at the intracellular recordings, it becomes clear what's happening. So this now is the membrane potential of the cell in which we are injecting a sinusoidal current, 20 millivolts. And here's the current, 300 picoamps. Spike on every single trial and every single peak. But at this point, you miss a beat. The adapting currents have kicked in. It doesn't reach threshold. And now you're getting it every other. Here it skips two. Every other, and actually it's quite stable. Once it catches on to the 1-2 mode, it stays there. Now, the thing is, if you give it exactly the same stimulus a second time, the patterns are similar at the beginning, right, every time, and at the end, every other time, but there's this transition period during which you start missing beats, and depending on the amount of noise, you could either fall into an odd or an even pattern. Every other on even or odd. And so what that suggests is that we take a look at our histogram, which is this, and sort it according to even and odd by hand. And if you do that, you get two clear patterns that it could fall into. But once it's fallen into the pattern, it's 100% reliable. There are occasionally, the odd time when it does catch in between. But by and large, it really separates into these two clusters.
What happens after 7 seconds? Have you measured
that? No, we stop the experiment at that point. We have to do these experiments in a stable way. Cells in the slice are slowly dying, so that you want to create stationary conditions. So you have a couple hours that you have, and if these are say 7-second trials, you want to let it rest in between, and you just are limited by the amount of data you can collect. Mm-hmm. You also want to do it at different frequencies. You want to do it with other parameters that you want to vary. But this is actually, I'm only using this for illustrative purposes, just to show you something obvious now, and that is that your eye is deceived by a diagram like this, because what you're not able to see here very clearly, but you are here, is the spatial correlation in the pattern of spikes across time that gets washed out, because you're not looking, your eye cannot really link up the right spikes. And what that suggests is that we ought to come up with some automated procedure for finding clusters of patterns in the pattern of spikes that would take this and automatically give you this, right? We can't rely on human abilities. First, we might miss something, but more importantly, it's not objective. We might start...
Maybe my eye's deceiving me again, but it looks a lot like the sort of the frequency. Once it falls into its sort of second, the next mode,
right,
the frequencies are the same, it's just there's an offset, at least.
Yeah, that's the point. It's exactly the point.
Yeah, I thought it was
even, odd, right?
Okay.
That's exactly right. So in other words, this frequency here is twice that frequency. So here's, I'm going to give you now just a very brief overview of a clustering procedure, which is by no means the only one and probably not the best, but it works. And we're going to try, we've developed it using surrogate data because we needed to know the ground truth. So here's an example of a data set that we created. And what we did was to put in, we created Poisson distributed spike times, and we inserted, in this case, four events. So with some probability, we just inserted another spike. Say the probability is a half. Within an event, we also jitter the time. So we could vary the jitter, the degree of jitter, a couple milliseconds or less than a millisecond. And we also added extra spikes just randomly. We also had empty, let's say in an event, we only included spikes with a certain probability, so in fact it might vary in reliability from 50% to 100%. So this is an example of one cluster that we want to pull out. We generated three of these, 1, 2, 3, and you can roughly see where the events are by I when they are grouped. But if you now shuffle the order, you get a pattern that is not so apparent. And if you do a histogram, post-stimulus time histogram, you can see the peaks, which clearly reflect specific events, but you've lost all information about the cluster. It just looks like there's a lot of events, and it's not clear which of these trials should go with which event. So this is the input to our clustering algorithm. Here's the first step. The first step is to start out with the raw histograms, with the raw rasters, and we take each one of these and convolve it with a Gaussian with a width that we think is similar to the precision of the jitter, so a few milliseconds. That gives you a vector that you can now take the inner product of with all the rest, so you end up with 150 by 150 matrix, where white is 1 and black is 0 in terms of the correlation between the two vectors. Obviously on the diagonal it's 1 because it's the same thing, and most of these are small, on the order of a few tenths. So in order to bring up the signal, we do a histogram equalization so that we can boost the high end. This is what it looks like after it's been normalized. And then we apply a clustering technique. They say it's a k-means variant for looking in the space of different trials and trying to cluster them, and you end up with this. And then once you have the order from the clustering, you can then re-display the original data, and now it becomes apparent what we put in, namely three different clusters with three different sets of events. So this works well in our surrogate data. Let's now turn to real data and see how well it does. Well, we started with in vitro data, and we started with a stimulus which is intermediate between a simple sine wave and very white noise. Namely, it's the sum of a low frequency sine wave and a high frequency sine wave, 6 hertz and 40 hertz, roughly two frequencies that are known to be very common in the hippocampus that are mixed together, and this might be kind of a surrogate for the kinds of synaptic input that are coming in to a cell in the hippocampus. And the question is, how does the neuron respond? It responds, here's 150 trials, here's the histogram, and now what we're going to do in the next slide is I'm going to blow up this little region here where there's clearly three events with some noise, and here there's a fourth event. And let's take a closer look at that using our clustering approach. So here's that one stretch, which is a window that is 500 milliseconds wide, so half a second. And this one is actually even smaller. This window is just 200 milliseconds wide. So we took these trials, 150 trials, put them through the clustering method, and we ended up with two clusters. Here's the actual waveform. Here are the two clusters. And what is apparent is that within the cluster, it's quite reliable, nearly 100%. The jitter is on the order of a few milliseconds. And the bottom cluster is characterized by the fact that it has a prompt spike that occurs before the main event, which it may or may not participate in. If it fires on that first event, which is probably related to one of the peaks here in the stimulus, then 200 milliseconds later, this is in seconds, so 1.9 seconds, that's 100 milliseconds. If it fires early here, it will also fire early here. If it fires early here, it will not fire then at this point, but it will fire a little bit later with two spikes separated by 20 milliseconds. So what this illustrates, and this is in vitro data, what this illustrates is that we should no longer be focusing and thinking about individual events as single spikes as being the relevant point, as the relevant signal. We should be thinking of spike patterns sequences of spikes that represent several, that could extend, that is to say there's a coherence length here of several hundred milliseconds. Depending on which pattern you get into, you can stay in this pattern for several hundred milliseconds in the slice recording. Yeah.
So that sort of raises the question of what was the history of fire before 1.9.
Okay, we can go back and look at that.
I also actually missed what these repeats for the same cell with these different cells.
These were the same cell, the same stimulus pattern, this one, repeatedly injected 150 times with some, this is like 3 seconds long with some rest period in between. So as stationary as possible a condition, and the within this window, you can roughly separate this into two clusters. And Mitya was just asking, you know, well, what happened before that? And the answer is that if you extend this window here, you don't see anything different. This seems to be a common event for both clusters.
Then they diverge.
Something happened between here and here that will put them down a railroad track. Now, if you remember about the simpler sine wave, okay, there it probably was some sort of stochastic fluctuation where it came to a bifurcation point. You know, the currents were relaxing, and depending on whether the noise kicked it into a spike or not on one trial, that would then set it down the road of every other trial. So you can imagine a small event here. It didn't have to be large. Stochastic fluctuation could have made the difference such that it was sent one way or the other.
Can you see just intuitively how your algorithm defines the group? Basically, how does it start dividing them into different groups?
Yeah, so it's k-means. Basically, you look at correlations between the vectors. So there's let's say you have 100 bins. It's 100 dimensional, 0 or 1. You convolve that to make it a smooth vector. So each one now each bin has a number, a real number, and you just take inner products between those trials. And you're looking for the clusters of vectors that are close together. Right, the vectors that are close together mean they have events that have occurred at roughly the same time.
No, I understand. But suppose you take one thing that you call a cluster, and there's still a little bit of jitter. I could still divide them in two clusters that would make them even more precise.
You can, but in order to do that, you're paying a price, which is that you're adding new parameters. So there's a way to tell how at what point are you overfitting? Because obviously you can continue doing that, but you're just fitting noise. And so you have to cut it off at some point. Here we actually started with two clusters and then increased it and just did it by hand. But there are automatic ways of doing it too. But we just didn't automate it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, especially when we look at the random input on some of the previous ones, it's sort of, if I was Bill Bial, like, okay, I want to apply some sort of reverse correlation to this. Try to find the optimal stimulus that caused it.
Right.
So, I mean, you're saying something different, but that might be convolved with another.
Yeah. That's right. So, really, what one interpretation is that there's some history parameter or history variables within the neuron or within the network, which carry additional information that determine whether or not you respond to a particular stimulus. Right. No, this we picked this as just a nice, convenient stimulus that we think is physiologically sensible. We could have picked another stimulus, but let me show you some more examples, because it turns out that
So what I think what Bill would say, well, you're looking at the event, okay, and it depends on what window you call your event. So if you take your pattern, and
right.
It's a very long window, okay, and it contains many of these
right.
things, then it'd still be responding to the same event.
Yeah, so traditionally an event is defined by this histogram. And what we're saying is that we really should redefine an event to include several spikes in a window of time. How big the window is will depend on the area you record from and the type of stimulus you use. We found by just empirically that in this case, windows of about half a second were optimal for finding these clusters.
I was referring when I said event, I meant stimulus event rather than spike event, but okay, same thing.
Yeah, you can also think about these as events too, but they're not as, well, I mean, it doesn't spike on every one of these peaks, obviously. That's because the cell has internal variables, intrinsic conductances that are being modulated by the stimulus. Yeah. This is rat in vitro from the prefrontal cortex.
What temperature?
Room temperature.
So what's the integration time if you reverse parallelogram, white noise measurement?
It's about
half second?
No, it's about 20 milliseconds.
20 milliseconds.
Yeah, so one of the things that we did, I mean, this is, we in our first science paper, we did the reverse correlation. it's only the right thing to do if it's a linear system. We know this is not a linear system, we did it anyway. So what you discover is the following, which is actually, I think, has some implications. So what is everyone here, I assume, knows what reverse correlation is. Here's the stimulus, fluctuating random stimulus. And then here's the spike patterns that are being generated. What you do is you take a little window around every spike and take that stimulus and average it across spikes. If you do that, here's the spike. You discover that the optimal waveform in a linear sense is one that is actually negative, hyperpolarized, before the event, and then very rapidly increasing just before the event.
That's the same thing with Pollock sees.
Yeah, I think this is a traditional reverse correlation, but you know, this does not capture all the information that determines whether or not a cell fires, right? Because this just tells you roughly what the linear thing is. The hyperpolarization turns off inactivation currents, so it decreases the sodium channel inactivation. dV/dt, the rate at which it rises, is clearly an important variable. But there are other variables, too, that are important. And what this is telling us is that there are variables that have long time histories, longer time constants.
Which are nonlinear.
And it's nonlinear, right. Well, let's go on. So I showed you this. This is two events. Similarly, here, it looks like there are two unreliable events. Actually, there's two clusters, each of which is quite highly reliable, but at different times. It's catching either this peak or that peak. But what about, so this is fine, this is in vitro data again. The criticism is that maybe this is just some artifact of the slice, and you know, you'll never get this sort of clustering in real data from real animals under real conditions. Well, here's an experiment that was done in Tom Albright's lab. It was instigated during a time when Tony Zadar was there, and he's now again at Cold Spring Harbor Lab, where he's working on auditory cortex of rats. And then Mike DeWeese, who is in transit between Cold Spring Harbor and UCSD, the last I heard. Do you know if he's taken the job? Does anybody know here? Okay, the last I heard, He was offered and accepted a job at UCSD. And then Giedris Barakas, who is a postdoc in Tom's lab. So what they did was to go to MT, right? This is the area Bill Newsom had been recording from. And they designed an optimal stimulus for getting timing information. Bill, in a sense, did it serendipitously. He didn't design the experiment in order to get spike timing information. What they did here was to find the preferred direction for a particular neuron in MT and then design a stimulus which would optimally fire it when it was moving in the preferred direction, and then jittered it back and forth in the preferred and anti-preferred direction with some time course. So here's the jittering. And here are the rasters from 63 trials. You get a very nice histogram, and the histogram has a width of about 5 milliseconds, so that's the precision. But you'll notice here that there's a great deal of variability in the peaks or the area under each one, and the reliability varied quite a bit. So what they concluded was that individual spikes carried a significant amount of information, but they weren't terribly reliable. They didn't always occur. So we got a hold of their raw data, these histograms, these raster plots. individual spike times for many trials, put them through our clustering technique. And what I'm showing you here are, in the next slide, these are the two windows I'm going to show you. This one here is about 200 milliseconds wide, where there are some unreliable events. And here's another window that is about 300 milliseconds wide. Here's the first window. Here's the second window. We now cluster them. And this now clusters into three events. Either the cell will fire at an early time, or a later time, or not at all. But if it does, it really, within these groups, it's really quite reliable with a width of about 5 milliseconds. Here, there are 5 clusters. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And this is now, again, it's like 10 synapses into the brain from the periphery. We're getting these very reliable and highly precise clusters. The cells are really, you know, responding, not responding the same way every time, but they're responding in a relatively small number of stereotyped ways with very high precision. That's really what this tells us. Yeah.
So if you do are they reordering the same for the two of those?
No. No, these clusters are not related to these. They're
if you broaden the window on which you made the clusters,
yeah,
what would have happened? I mean, what I mean is that you picked two particular.
Well, yeah, what we do is we move it along. We have determined just by looking at many cells that the length of time over which you get these correlated clusters is on the order of 200 to 300 milliseconds. So we just move them along and we get the clusters. So move them along. I just gave you a couple examples here.
So what is, I'm sorry, just maybe you don't have to answer, but just a technical point. So how is that 200, 300 millisecond window determined? If I make a plot of the number of clusters as a function of time, I would see some plateau or something. What is that?
This was not done systematically, in the sense that we only tried a few data sets with a few window sizes, and just empirically found that this window size was optimal in terms of getting reliable clusters, as you see, on the order of 2 to 8 clusters per window. But it obviously is going to require more systematic effort to really find out how general that is across many different brain areas and cell types.
Eric,
yeah.
How the other end of the window size is determined?
How the other end?
The smaller. I mean, you use the Gaussian filter, right?
Okay. So. Yeah, so that's right. So the one parameter that really didn't vary too much was the Gaussian smoothing filter. And we set that according to previous work that had been done, like the work that I showed you from Baer and Koch on the widths of the windows that have been determined from other experiments. And typically, in the case of the MT, it was 5 milliseconds. That's what we used for these clusters. You'll see now in Pam Reinagle's data, we actually used a window that was about a millisecond, or a Gaussian smoothing filter with a millisecond. So here's data from Pam Reinagle. And this is one that really is very puzzling. They produce a result that we didn't expect and we don't understand. So recall that she was recording from the thalamus, the LGN visual thalamus in anesthetized cats, to a full field flickering stimulus, right? And typically her recordings would go for about 8 seconds. You're just seeing here a small segment, 2 second chunk, 80 trials from a single cell. And this is the raster plot showing you the very reliable events. And this is the traditional way that neuroscientists really think about their data when they publish them and when they present them. So what we did was to take her raw spike times. We used the first 350 milliseconds as our window for clustering. And we found that there were 2 clusters that were quite robust, cluster 1, cluster 2, and that cluster 2 was characterized, you could tell it by looking at the first spike, because it occurred about 10 milliseconds before this first spike in cluster 1. But if it's fired early here, it would miss the next event, but then would catch the next event after that. So it misses one, catches this one, misses this one, catches this one with less reliability than cluster 1, but then inserts another event here in between. What's amazing is that although we clustered it on the first 350 milliseconds, this different pattern continued for the entire trial of 8 seconds. So what that is telling us is that there's some history here, some stability that lasts for many seconds in the LGN that determines whether or not you're going to fire here. It can be predicted according to a spike that occurs at the very beginning. Yes?
Over time course of the recording, 8 trials, 2-second trials.
Right, 8-second trials, right.
There's probably some interest in those interval. Where are those second cluster trials relative to the first cluster trials? Are they interleaved?
They're all interleaved. They're interleaved.
They don't come back. I mean, LGN is very, has goes through cycles. Responsivity of cells changes over the course of 20 minutes or so. You can see bands.
In vivo, you get secular changes, you get neuromodulators that are states of arousal changing. Yeah. Doesn't seem to be correlated with state of arousal. But we're looking at other possibilities. Yeah.
Another way of looking at this, you look back a little bit, you see, you're going through and you say, are there 2 clusters or are there 1 cluster? If you took a moving window across, in some places you'd see them actually become the same cluster, right? You wouldn't be able to tell if they're separate clusters.
Right. If all you did was to look at this little window here, right, you'd say that, oh, this is there at the same cluster, but then immediately there'd be a difference. So if the window was included this, we would catch this as a second cluster.
So, there's another way of thinking about it. The differentiation between 1 cluster and 2 cluster changes in time, right? I mean, it's almost like you have 2 clusters becoming 1 cluster. And then
So how do we think about this as a dynamical system? This is all phenomenology, I'm telling you. This is just facts. These are experiments. And how are we going to think about them from a perspective of mechanism? I'll let me get to that. I just want to finish this part. So this is one cell. Here's 4 cells. And it's quite common to find 2 clusters. As you can see, in these 4 cells, we found 2 clusters. And they all had the character that on some spikes, namely the ones that are joined by green, the events are the same at the same time. But in one cluster, you could either get spikes that weren't in the other or vice versa. So here's a case of an event in the first cluster, not in the second. Here's one that's in the second, not in the first.
Harry, are you saying is the algorithm dependent, the clustering?
Well, no. This was very robust. I mean, it didn't matter what 350 milliseconds window we took, we'd get the same clusters. But the part that I think is important is that it's persistent. There's a time constant here, which is, you know, at least one order of magnitude more than the window of the clustering.
So here you have an amazing thing, like 2 clusters which have a common history for almost a second.
Yeah, well, 400 milliseconds. Yeah.
Very long time.
Yeah. So that's right. There must be an internal variable that remembers that it's part of one cluster and not the other.
So I mean, if you just think of, I mean, maybe you're going to get to this in terms of models, but if you have an integrate and fire model with a spike after potential, then even though the after potential might be very short. Milliseconds, it can kind of have consequences that ramify for a long, long, long time if the noise is very low.
Well, in the case of integrate and fire, you really don't have long time constants in it. It's just whatever that time constant is that you put in for your after hyperpolarization. Much longer than, I mean, that's much shorter than anything you'll find here. So I think that's okay. So one last empirical result. Okay, so this has to do with neuromodulation. So again, one of the criticisms was that in vivo you have a very you don't have a firm floor to stand on because you're like out at sea, where the neuromodulatory state of the cortex is changing from moment to moment, depending on your attentional state, your arousal state, and things that happen around you, you looking around. And this is something we can actually explore in our slice preparation. So one of the neuromodulators is acetylcholine, and what we put into the bath is a chemical which mimics acetylcholine, binds to what's called a muscarinic receptor, and it blocks potassium currents. So it's a way of manipulating, in a sense, the intrinsic responsivity of the neuron. In particular, carbachol, in response to a simple square pulse, will increase the number of spikes. So it makes it more excitable. It also obviously is changing time constants, but let's just look at that. So here's now a response to our fluctuating frozen noise. This was done by Acacia Tang. She's a postdoc in the lab. And you clearly are getting events that are consistent across these two states, with and without the neuromodulator. These are very reliable. So in order to compare them, what we're going to do is to flip them here. So the top is control, and the bottom is carbachol. And what this shows is that in carbachol, you're adding new spikes. The times of the times at which the spikes occurred in the control data are also preserved. In other words, what carbachol is doing is not just making it more excitable, but is making it more sensitive to small fluctuations. It will respond with more spikes at precise times. Let's go back to the beginning, and let's say that we're able to time travel back to 1995. This is a figure from the Science paper. Look at that. There are clusters in here that you can actually see because we actually made the ticks big enough so that you can see them. In other words, it took us 10 years to see what's obvious in that diagram, which is that the cell is responding in different ways on different trials, but reliably, this, and this, these three responses are all from the same cluster, right? And on the left. Let's see, how many of you heard Paul Tiesinger talk? He gave a lecture here, I think, a couple weeks ago. Did anybody hear his lecture? Okay, so I'll just summarize his lecture in 2 minutes. Okay, so Paul and Peter Thomas, Peter is a mathematician and Paul's a physicist, have been trying to develop both looking at models like integrating fire and also developing analytic methods for trying to examine these spike patterns. And here's, I'm just going to give you a very brief summary of the conclusions they've come to. So that first of all, if you think about the response of a cell to a pattern, say fluctuating current input or a sine wave, you can think of it as a dissipative system in which, depending on, regardless of the initial condition of the cell, with time it will converge to a particular pattern, right? That's the case if there were a unique pattern for a given stimulus. But we see that in many cases, in our models, we can reproduce this in integrating fire models to the very same stimuli, in vitro and in vivo, there's more than one pattern, okay? So how could we understand that? How could it be that there are two different spike patterns that the cell can converge to for the very same stimulus? It must be that there's an internal variable and that these internal variables, I call it history, are going to predispose the cell to respond differently to the very same stimulus. How you get into those two different patterns must have something to do with a decision that was made at some point. And if you think about it from a mathematical perspective, and if you write down it, the cell as a dynamical system, this is, you can think of it in terms of bifurcation theory, right? This is a dynamical system. You come to a point where a small fluctuation can send you down one valley or another valley. But once you're in the valley, it's quite stable. It's a dissipative valley, so that small perturbations will return you to that pattern, but it's a different pattern depending on which valley you've gotten into. In fact, the way that we're thinking about it is in terms of thinking about these spike time patterns as attractors, right? As the kinds of attractors you get in dynamical systems theory, you can get a point attractor, you can get line attractors, you can get limit cycles. Well, this is a different kind of attractor. It's an attractor that corresponds to a pattern of spike times. And depending on which one you're in, you can get stable, reliable responses in that valley that's quite different than the other valley, and that depends on your history. It depends on how you got there. But once you're in it, It's as I showed you here, it's fairly robust to small perturbations.
So, in this particular experiments, the history has been identical trial to trial, right? I mean, so for example, you may have one of these, let's say cluster 2 happening on trial 53 and trial 81. Well, what's the difference between the history preceding 53 and 81? It looks identical.
It looks identical, but it's telling us that there's something that we're not controlling that isn't. What could that be?
You could certainly say that in cortex and LGM.
So in vivo, there's all kinds of things that people have thought about. For example, we're looking for something that, with PAM, that has a very long time constant. Adaptation may be one of those. We know that there are mechanisms in the retina, in photoreceptors as well as other places in the retina, in which you can adapt to different light levels. And that may be changing the response properties of a cell downstream because you now are encoding it differently, right?
But you pop back in the next cell.
Not in the LGN. It's okay, you're right. But there's in between trials, there's a dead period, right, where there's a gray screen. So
that begs the question, why you didn't adapt in every trial, only in some trials?
Well, that's where we have to go and look at the actual order of the trials and see if there's any history in the different what happened just before cluster 1. Was there something different about that trial?
Getting back to the integrated and finer model, there's typically the spike after potential. So, if your input took you close to threshold and then on one trial noise brought you above, then you're going to get a hyperpolarization that maybe cancels the firing next time, so you don't.
We can reproduce this phenomenon with an integrating fire model,
right.
But the time in window over which you can cluster is limited to about 50 to 100 milliseconds, right? With a 25 millisecond time constant for after hyperpolarization. Now, real neurons have mechanisms in them, channels that have time constants that are much longer, and so that could take you up to maybe 500 milliseconds or a second.
So if your spike
right.
after potential includes, let's say it's several times longer than the characteristic interval between events, then
right.
You're going to get pretty robust reaction.
What I think what you're heading toward is what we have also, I think. Started to explore, which is that one of the internal variables we know to be important in neurons that have long time constants is calcium. So it could be that if there's a calcium-activated potassium current, right, that would be...
Have we tried blocking that on slice?
We haven't yet done that. We have done some modeling studies, and that suggests it would be an important variable. Okay, so it's late. Let me just show you one more little... This is now an integrating fire model. In which we've injected into the model. Okay, integrating fire, for those of you who don't know, is one of the simplest possible models that doesn't really have, it's too simple really to represent a real neuron, but it has the advantage you can analytically study it, right? So what happens is that if it's like an RC decay, and you simply add up all the inputs that are coming in with that filter, if you reach a threshold of a fixed voltage, then you issue a spike, and then you reset at some point below threshold, and again integrate and fire. So that's what this model is. And what we're doing is we're injecting this over and over again with noise. So we're integrating fire plus NDK with noise. And if there were no noise, you'd get this spikes at different times. This is varying the amplitude of the signal. And you can see that as you increase the amplitude, you're getting the spike times are varying from early to late. But I think the part that is interesting here, because this is a very simple model, is that we can reproduce a lot of the structure, these bifurcations that occur in the model, and it can be studied analytically. For example, below a certain amplitude, you only get one spike time. But if you're above it, you might get this one or this one. So that gives you this clustering. Similarly, you can see here that there's an event at, this is the fourth spike, which has noise on it. But at the bifurcation, the noise gets higher and more variable, and it jumps to another time. And a new event occurs, five. So a lot of the phenomenology that I've shown you in data can be reproduced, even in a very simple model, but not all of it, not this very long 8-second time constant, time history.
It would seem like it really depends on the parameters quite a lot. If the, you know, if the after potential overlaps, you know, two or three events, then chances are pretty high.
Yeah, you know, that's a reasonable explanation. We can explore that. And want to thank all of my collaborators. Both on the left side are people who have passed through my lab, starting with Zach Manin. A lot of the in vitro recordings were from Jean-Marc Fallou, who now is moving to Duke University. Paul Tiziga is at UNC. Peter Thomas is moving to Oberlin. Suzanne Schreiber was a visiting graduate student now in Berlin. We really had a lot of fun interacting with some experimentalists, and you saw their raw data. The clustering that we did with them, primarily from Clay Reed's lab when Paul Reinigel was a postdoc there, now on the faculty, Pam is on the faculty at UCSD, and then the group in Tom Albright's lab that really took it to the MT and really provided us with data that we really needed. So what good is timing? What good is a single spike? Well, there may be times in your life when really survival depends on being at the right place at the right time. And if you don't have your mouth open, you may miss the crucial event. But you shouldn't think of it in terms of a one-time event. You should be thinking of it in terms of a sequence of events. In other words, you want to be able to repeat this someday. And it may be different in different contexts and different streams. And maybe that has to do something with the fact that the very same neurons in your brain are going to respond in two different ways to the very same stimulus. And taking us way back to the beginning of the lecture, remember when I was talking about Hubel and Wiesel, right? They didn't see any of this phenomenology because they didn't have precise enough control of the stimulus. It's now clear, at least in my mind, from just looking at the data, we just picked these data sets because they're around, right? It's very likely this is true in other parts of the cortex too. What it means is that the cortex, far, far from being a sloppy system, is an extremely precise machine that responds for a precisely presented stimulus in a very precise, reliable way, but not the same way every time. A small number of ways. What consequence does that have for information processing? We don't know. But we do know that spike timing is really important for things like synaptic plasticity. Spike time dependent synaptic plasticity. We know that it's important downstream because different spike times will give rise to different patterns of spikes in the downstream neurons that are converging. The spikes converge, synapses are activated, and you may or may not get a spike out of the next neuron. So correlations in the spike timing of neurons will propagate through a system that has a hierarchy in it. So I think that we're at the stage now where we really have to go back and rethink some fundamental assumptions we've made about how the cortex is organized. We have no idea how the spike time information is used. It's not clear to me what the actual information content is. In fact, it may not be important from the perspective of information. It may be important from the perspective of how the system regulates the flow of information, maybe a control system, a way of controlling the flow of information, not necessarily the information itself that's being represented. And the fact that it's immune to neuromodulators, to a lot of variety of different systems, the different things that we're throwing at it, again, suggests that the nervous system was built with this in mind. It's not just an accident that the neuromodulators are varying the sensitivity of a neuron to specific information in the fluctuations. So this basically, I think, is really more the beginning. It's just pointing out some basic facts that we've uncovered about the cortex that we didn't know before. There's a lot of things that can be explored with modeling studies, with analytic approaches, to try to understand what are the biophysical variables that underlie the phenomenon I showed you. But I think that the really important part now that we're going to have to go back and rethink is the overall organization of the cortex, because it's telling us that we shouldn't think of the cortex anymore as a purely kind of associative network, right? The spike times, I think, really do matter. So there's some sort of, it's beginning to look a little bit more like a communication system.
What kind of effect is there from the lag from one pyramidal cell to the next?
It's on the order, it depends on whether the axon is myelinated or not, but it can vary from a fraction of a millisecond to several milliseconds. So, for example, between long-range connections, say from the thalamus to the cortex, there's a very large dispersion, anywhere from a millisecond up to 10 milliseconds. And within this cortex itself, there's long-range horizontal connections. They tend to be slow. The intracortical connections between cortical areas tend to be fast.
And then the delay through a neuron is about what?
Delay through the neuron depends obviously on how fast it can respond with the spike, but the relevant number is not so much the delay, it's the synaptic response time, which is on the order of a millisecond or two. Yeah, there's some very beautiful work that was done by Alexander Treves showing that in what's called a balanced condition, when the excitatory and inhibitory inputs to a neuron are roughly balanced, that the cell is responding to fluctuations rather than to the mass drive. And that gives you the irregular timing that you see in cortical recordings. And in that state, what's interesting is that the time constant that with which the system responds is dominated by the synaptic time constant, not the membrane time constant of the neuron. And I think Misha did some work along the same lines at roughly the same time. All this is basically pointing us toward the direction of a system that can respond very rapidly and very precisely, right? What you do with it, there are dozens of ideas out there of people who are pursuing different directions. Who knows where we'll end up.
So you showed that if you inject a sine wave into red cortical slice neuron, first it will follow each period, it will produce a spike, and then it will start alternating. Clearly, so if that was your only neuron, if you the equivalent in Tamarinical's experiments would mean that first you would see a stimulus flickering at, say, 4 hertz, and then it would go down to 2 hertz,
right?
Which, of course, you don't, which means that the neighboring cells will be signaling in the other phase. It would be doing at the same time one of the other clusters. So over a population of cells, you do have the entire representation. And I think what you're basically showing is that cells that not all cells fire at all times.
So, well, here's what we don't know, and this is a real important experiment. We need to be able to record from two neurons at the same time to the same stimulus, and is it the case that they're both in the same cluster?
Which they can be, because then you will see frequency happening after a while, if you look at it.
Well, that was a very artificial case of ejecting a pure sine wave, although there's an interesting bit of history here. So Bob Rodick once published a paper in which he cautioned visual scientists from using monitors that have a refresh rate that flickers at 60 hertz, because he was finding cells in the visual system that were following it. In other words, you put a monitor there and you get the cells firing like this, chattering away.
Yeah, but even up to 100 hertz.
Right.
You find in your autograelograms.
Yeah, so that was a kind of a, you know, he was cautioning that this is an artifact, but, you know, maybe telling us something about the actual capability of the device. Peter.
So I found this, one of these points that you just made sort of toward the end very interesting. I wonder if you could expand on it, the idea that you need the timing to get signals to penetrate these multiple layers without dying out. Is there a way to pursue that? I mean, that's quite
sure. Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. That's I think one of the clear messages from the fact that not all synapses are equally reliable is that there may be certain pathways through this network that are reliable, and that the spike timing, the actual order with which spikes come in and summate, may actually give rise to something that's reliable. Moshe Abele has introduced this concept of what he called a synfire chain many years ago. And although I think that the idea that it's a simple hierarchy and you're going in a feed-forward way may be oversimplified, I think there's some truth to the fact that through convergence, and you don't need that many spikes converging, but if they do converge reliably at a certain time and fire the cell at reliably, that you could get a pattern of spikes. It's also related to an idea that goes way back to Hebb on something he called phase sequences. So he had this idea of assemblies of neurons, but sequences of spikes that would fire in the assembly that he thought were important for the persistence of memory. So how is it that the memory of a stimulus outlasts the stimulus? There has to be some trace that continues to percolate through the system. So, you know, I think a lot of these old ideas can be revived and try to understand a little bit better about the, now that we understand the machinery a little better, see whether we can accommodate them. So, Mishi, you've been uncharacteristically quiet.
Yeah, but you mentioned already Moshe Abele.
Okay.
He also reported a long time ago that there are spike patterns, but the difference is that your spike patterns are controlled by the stimulus prism. You have the same stimulus many, many times.
Right.
And he claimed that even without this precise institution,
well, if
something, but there's nothing repeating 100 times.
Yeah, this is where I think our we have to be cautious, okay? So one way that you could go, which I don't want to go, is to say, you have encoded extra information about the stimulus in the actual precise pattern of spikes. I actually don't believe that. I don't believe that that's not the only interpretation for what I've just told you. I've used the stimulus in order to demonstrate the precision of the cortex and following this, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's using each individual spike and each individual pattern of spikes to code a specific piece of information. More likely, and it comes from this observation by Moshe Abeles, even in the spontaneous activity, even without any stimulus, you have patterns of spikes that are in the network that are percolating around, and what the that are occur above chance, and it's a whole population. It's not just single neurons. It's the whole populations that are firing in a coherent way.
It's called thinking, right?
and in fact may represent in some parts of the brain, not necessarily in the visual cortex, but maybe in some prefrontal cortex, may represent the expectations and your internal states. And what the stimulus is doing is reorganizing those internal patterns. It's not necessarily driving them, it's reorganizing them, picking out different subsets.
So you say the patterns that you observe are not actually intrinsic, so you just somehow uncover them.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And it may be just if a stimulus comes, it may trigger something that then persists by virtue of intrinsic recurrent connections.
It's less surprising that you, even MMT, you see something in it, because this is something
right.
That
somehow... And that's right. So MT, right. So MT may have five different patterns in that little column, and you're hitting it really hard, and it will fall into one of those other one of those five patterns, depending on top down input from the prefrontal cortex and depending on other neuromodulators and other things. Yeah.
That's really difficult in kind of thinking it's a tractor network, because it's really parameter sensitive. If you turn down your Gaussian filter down, then you will see more patterns, and they are not precisely aligned to each other. So it's not a good analogy.
Well, you know, I want to distinguish our analysis methods, which are, like I said, are probably not optimal, from the actual patterns in the data. So I think they're real. I think there are patterns in the data. We're picking out some of them. There may be others. And it's those that I think are the tractor states. It's properties of the dynamical system. The brain, the neurons are nonlinear. They're connected up. They form a very complex dynamical system. It has certain patterns that it will fall into, and those are what I'm calling the attractors. And they're temporal sequences of spikes. They're not just point attractors where all the neurons fall into one pattern, right? Like a hot field net. It's a dynamical sequence.
So I mean, the thing about the about the data is falling into some attractors that in these experiments, primarily the cell is locking the stimulus, right? I mean, most of the
right.
If you change the stimulus a little bit, of course, the spectrometers will all be just completely different.
Right.
I mean, basically, you know, first order, it's locking to the stimulus on a short time scale. But there's just kind of, you know, long-term history. I guess it's kind of a question of, you know, do you think that the neuron is kind of, how different a state is it really in between those two clusters? And one kind of analysis that may be interesting to do would be to say, in those two clusters, like, what's the spike triggered average? Was it significantly different?
Yeah, that would be, if we had interstellar recordings, of course, that'd be fun to do.
Well, that gets it.
Yeah.
I mean,
because, the simplest model is that the neuron is actually trying to do the same computation all the time, and there's this spike after hyperpolarization that causes it to have some dependence on the previous spike, but it's not like you shouldn't necessarily think of it as a very different attractor state.
So I think your class of explanation, I think, will account for some of the data, and I think that we can demonstrate it in a model. So yes, but I think that there are also going to be network effects, this adaptation effects, and I think we're seeing that in the LGN. And I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't even true in MT. So, you know, really, I think you're right. We need to be able to do more experiments to look at the actual internal state of that particular neuron to see how much of it is determined by that.
Whether it's intrinsic in the neuron or it's a network effect, there's still a question of whether the clustering itself represents signal or noise. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've got the cell in two stable states with the same stimulus, it's either telling you about two different aspects of the stimulus intentionally, sort of because I'm going to tell you about part X,
right,
the subset of the whole stimulus, or I'm going to tell you about part Y. Or it's saying, I can't tell you about the whole stimulus, even part X, I'm just going to tell you about half of it now and half of it later. And that sort of leads to a fundamentally different interpretation of...
That would be fun. That would be fun. So in other words, you would say that the same stimulus, which is presented once, right, could get cause your brain to press the button with your right hand or your left hand because it was the initial state of the brain was different. And that actually happens when you have these stimuli that are noisy and ambiguous.
Or bistable, but, actually.
Yeah, or bistable. So that's a possibility, yeah.
Well, you had that example of where you split into odd and even.
Right.
And so you get these established clusters where you have a high-frequency signal and it breaks down into two half-frequency signals. Well, it seems like that would be a pretty useful mechanism if you want to track something which is a much higher frequency.
Mm-hmm.
The signal breaks down into a bunch of sub-frequencies which are all phase-shifted from each other.
Right.
So you're basically retaining a signal with a much higher
frequency. Yeah, and that actually happens in the peripheral auditory system. Yeah. Okay. So neurons can't follow 5 kilohertz, but they'll fire at a particular phase when they do. They'll skip.
Yeah, so the population together.
The population as a whole preserves all of it, yeah. Yeah, that could be going on too, yeah.
So let's take a break. So if Terry's been talking now for 2 hours, so so thanks, Terry.
You're welcome.